Very barely alive mix from Blondtron.
Very hungover mix from Blondtron.
You know about V H O M .com coming soon. Anyway, also .coms you can check out is Blondtron.com.
Blondtron.com. BLONDTRON.com.
And also on MySpace, you can check out Crimes and Treasons. And you can check out Blondtron on Crimes and Treasons. You can check out me on Crimes and Treasons. Stephen Harper's got Crimes and Treasons now. Cool. Anybody got a Crimes and Treasons, you can get it.
It's basically like the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
Bob Ross has David, a MySpace.
David Suzuki.
Bob Ross, man.
Yeah, Bob Ross. You got to give shout outs.
Big old shout outs.
Big old shout outs to Bob Ross.
Where's
the Peter Mansbridge?
We
got to get that out there, Peter Mansbridge.
Jesus has a MySpace.
Oh, there's like a bunch of Jesuses.
Yeah, but my Jesus is the best.
that's the new podcast name. When people download the podcast today, it's going to say, my Jesus is the best.
Yeah.
The new shit. My Jesus is the best. I'm getting a t-shirt with that on, actually. Again, that. You know, straight up. Or getting the new...
Dude, my Jesus is MySpace kicks your Jesus is MySpace's ass.
That's happening.
That just happened.
You heard it right away. Crimes and Treasons instantly got the lockdown on the new Jesus. You know what I mean?
Holy shit.
We're bigger than the new Jesus. The Beatles are out of here, you know? Those fools are dead. So it's all about the new My Jesus is better than yours.
Yeah.
Anyway, make sure you tune into our show every single week because we're the best ever.
Check the podcast.
Whatever.
You know I'll be back.
You know she'll be back. And you know.
Next time I'll have a non-man voice and I won't scream my head off the night before.
I'll have my non-girl voice
I'll have
too.
My Blondtron voice back.
There you go. Perfect. Perfect. Anyway. Basically, we're cool and you know it. So we're gonna go. My science project is up next. They're not here, but they're in Edmonton, which is like being here in spirit. Or is it Calgary? Or is it all the same? Really?
It's all
Those
the
are
same.
Different places.
I think after you get past the Rockies, it's just like, eh.
It's just Canada.
This is where the provinces get really square.
Yeah, it's just moose. It's just moose and rocks and.
I'm pretty sure we've offended like a really large portion of everyone.
Oh well. Hopefully you don't have any listeners out there. Anyway, make sure you listen to us. We're cool, and I think we're gonna play. The My Science podcast right now. So yeah, My Science Project is starting now. Cool. I don't know what they've got. If you haven't tuned in before to My Science Project, they talk about cool things like penis fencing and some pretty interesting science stuff.
Is that like having a sword fight?
Yeah, it's like having a sword fight.
Is that like that puppetry of the penis stuff?
I actually haven't seen it, but I understand it's like fighting.
I hope you guys haven't done it either.
it's apparently like a knife fight, but a little bit different.
Crimes and Treasons is a penis fencing free zone.
It just kind
no
of
homo, though, no homo.
Oh, it just got really awkward in here. Yeah.
Especially since Brendan whipped it out. Come on, dude, put it back in there, man.
Sorry, guys.
Dude, I'm not fighting. I'm not fighting. I don't want to fight. Okay, my science project. No penis fencing. My Jesus is better than yours, and we out. .com and .net.
Come on, everybody! We're going back to the pile.
Yeah, come on.
We've got to work for a better future. We've got to join hands for tomorrow. Take the first step and you will see the future begins with you and me. We can start to make a difference if we want it for our children. Recycle that can and plant that tree, because the future begins with you and me. The future begins with you and me.
Zoom a little zoom in a rocket ship. Off we go on a trip. Heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zoom into the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha, 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 ha.
Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hi there, everyone, and welcome to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM. This year, we're going to be doing what's become our annual Best Science of the Past Year show, consulting publications such as Science and Nature and Scientific American, and throwing in a few other relevant stories that have just been published, so they're hot off the scientific press. And it was quite a year this year. We had everything from Al Gore's film An Inconvenient Truth, all about global warming, proved to be the highest grossing documentary of all time, to Woo Suk Hwang, the Korean researcher who faked his embryonic stem cell research that was apparently groundbreaking but turned out to be a scam. He's still in the courts trying to get that sorted out and says he'd like to return to stem cell research, and I'll bet he would. The NBA tried out a newfangled basketball that, according to material scientists, was meant to be an improvement over the leather traditional ball, but it was such a dud that NBA players had a huge revolt over it, and the NBA finally recapitulated, switching back to the old leather balls as of January 1st, 2007. Today we're going to talk more about some science stories that happened in the last 12 months, stuff that has to do with mathematics, of course, an always sexy subject, and in line with sexy science, we're going to be looking at how lingerie compromises men's ability to barter. We're also going to have a little bit of a discussion on evolution and this new fish-slash-land-loving creature that was found high up in the Canadian North. And towards the end of the show, I'll share with you some scientifically proven New Year's resolutions that will improve your life. Among the best science stories of 2006 is this one, which has a little bit of quasi-CanCon to it. It's about a fossil that was discovered high up on Ellesmere Island in Canada's north. And it was discovered by a team led by Edward Deschler of the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, Neil Shubin of the University of Chicago, and Farish Jenkins from Harvard. And the three of them are paleontologists who decided to go to Ellesmere Island because, of all things, they noticed in an undergraduate textbook that Ellesmere Island was exposed Devonian rock that had not been explored previously for vertebrate fossils. And Devonian rock dates back about 300 and some million years ago. It's an era of fish predominantly. But other fossils that have been found date back 365 million years ago, where a fish was found with limbs that bear digits, so like our fingers. And 385 million years ago, fossil remains suggest that fish may have been beginning to, quote-unquote, walk in shallow water. So this team went to Ellesmere Island to see what they could see, and despite all the incredibly harsh conditions, which made them only able to work about 2 months of the summer every year, they found a new fossil that is pretty much an ideal transition between fish and land-loving tetrapods. This fossil they call Tiktaalik rosea, and Tiktaalik is the local Inuktitut word for a large freshwater fish seen in the shallows. Now, at the time that Tiktaalik was alive in the Devonian period, it wasn't so frigidly cold up there. About 375 million years ago, it was part of a supercontinent that straddled the equator, and it was a subtropical delta. Now, this animal is really interesting because of this ideally transitional state where it has various morphological features that are very, very similar to what you'd see in any animal that would live on land. These include things that are not fish-like at all, like having a proper defined neck, robust ribs, which would need to support the body mass rather than softer cartilaginous skeletal structures. The fossils also have front fins that are beginning to look like limb bones, where they actually have an internal skeletal arm structure, including elbows and wrists, and they have fins instead of clear fingers. So it's really this gorgeous meshing of fish and, as I said, tetrapods or four-legged animals on land. The Tiktaalik fossils, fish-like fossils, also have bony scales and fins. Further to that, this fossil has evidence that its small gill slit on the side of the head is on its way to becoming an ear. So it's really this amazing combination of stuff. They posit that Tiktaalik was a not very great swimmer, that it lived in these shallower waters and most likely went on to land to escape predators, so it would haul itself out of the water as a defense. Some people have likened Tiktaalik to Archaeopteryx, which is another gorgeously intermediate fossil specimen between dinosaurs and birds. What Tiktaalik also does is it puts another nail in the coffin of creationism, or what's called intelligent design theory, or ID theory. And the proponents of ID theory try to disguise their work and try to couch their ideas in scientific terms. And one of the things that they argue is that it's impossible to find this Darwinian transition of animals, that you don't get something turning into something else, because of course things were intelligently designed to be as they are, and they have always been that way. So in addition to something like Archaeopteryx, which was an incredibly significant find for this reptile or dinosaur to bird transition, Tiktaalik is almost more monumental because it's so much older, and it represents this absolutely significant change from animals that lived exclusively in the water to an entirely new group of animals that now could live on land successfully.
All right, kids, it is now my job to teach you the theory of evolution.
Oh, boy!
Now, I, for one, think that evolution is a bunch of bull crap, but I've been told I have to teach it anyway. It was thought up by Charles Darwin, and it goes something like this. In the beginning, we were all fish, okay, swimming around in the water. And then one day, a couple of fish had a retard baby, and the retard baby was different, so it got to live. So retard fish goes on to make more retard babies, and then one day, a retard baby fish crawled out of the ocean with its mutant fish hands, and it had butt sex with a squirrel or something and made this. Retard frog squirrel, and then that had a retard baby, which was a monkey fish frog, and then this monkey fish frog had butt sex with that monkey, and that monkey had a mutant retard baby that screwed another monkey, and that made you. So there you go. You're the retarded offspring of five monkeys having butt sex with a fish squirrel. Congratulations.
I can't take it anymore.
Yep, you see? I knew that would happen.
Yeah.
That was the New York Dolls doing a live performance of their song Dance Like a Monkey off their latest album, released, I believe, in 2006. You're listening to My Science Project, the Best of 2006 show with your host, Julia, me. My co-host, Anne, is going to be doing the show in another 2 weeks from now. If you'd like to get in touch with either Anne or myself, you can email us at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. When he died in 1665, the French mathematician Pierre de Fermat left behind one of the most frustrating mathematical problems in the history of mathematics, and that was Fermat's last theorem, which was a relatively simple theorem that he left behind in his notes, but it was not with the proof. And so up until 1995, the proof for Fermat's last theorem was left unproven. And it was proven by Andrew Wiles. It was announced first in 94, and then there were some critical problems with Wiles' first proposed proof. He developed the whole thing in 7 years in almost total secrecy. And when it was announced in 95, it was then accepted because this critical flaw had been resolved. And so that sets a bit of context for this next math story, which is the proving of the Poincaré conjecture, which is named after another French mathematician. And there were two prizes out there for solving the Poincaré conjecture. There was the Fields Medal, which is called sometimes the Nobel Prize of Mathematics. And then there was also, more recently announced in 1999, the Clay Mathematics Institute Award. And one of these $1 million awards included solving Henri de Poincaré's conjecture, which was proposed a few centuries after Pierre de Fermat in 1904. And the Poincaré conjecture is something that I'm not going to really touch with a figurative 10-foot pole, not only because this is on radio, but I really don't understand it whatsoever. To put it into a small hyper nutshell, it's the most famous open problem in topology, which has to do with space and dimensions and manifolds. And that's as technical as I can possibly manage to get. But what's really interesting here is that not only was the Poincaré conjecture solved, proven, in 2006, but it was done by an eccentric, and this is fairly standard for many great mathematicians, eccentric fellow named Grigory Perelman, who is a Russian mathematician who's been employed both in Russia and in the U.S. at various very highly reputable institutes. Perelman was one of four winners of the Fields Medal, and all the winners are mathematicians under 40. But he refused not only the Fields Medal, he also refused the Clay Mathematics Prize, which carries, of course, the $1 million bounty. So not only did he not even show up for the awards ceremony, he declined the money and everything. The reason that he did this is somewhat, again, typical of many great mathematicians, in that Perelman respects and admires the purity of mathematics and the doing for the doing's sake. And sort of like another famous mathematician, Euler, eschews many of the sort of worldly things that the rest of us tend to be more concerned with. Further to these sort of aesthetic reasons for doing mathematics and for not caring about recognition other than that of his peers and having solved the conjecture, there were also some authorship problems, some plagiarism issues, where Perelman posted his proofs online in at least as much detail as would normally be demanded by a formal mathematics journal. And some people tried to cash in, if you will, on these proofs and publish their own works suggesting that they were adding to the proofs or completing parts that Perelman hadn't done properly. One of these papers was published in the Asian Journal of Mathematics and at least to some degree recanted later by the authors. Perelman summed up that, and I quote, "As long as I was not conspicuous, I had a choice, either to make some ugly thing," which he refers to the fuss about the mathematics community lack of integrity and these plagiarism issues, "or if I didn't do this kind of thing, to be treated as a pet. Now, when I become a very conspicuous person, I cannot stay a pet and say nothing. That is why I had to quit." So he wiped his hands clean of the whole plagiarism and authorship fiasco, and is probably doing some other equally ingenious thing at the moment. So that was one of the highlights from 2006 discussed in both Nature and in Science. And the proofs were published online at www.arxiv.org, arxiv.org, if you want to check them out. This next story is also related to mathematics, and it's hot off the press. It was published in Neuron in January 18th of 2007, and it's a study that looks at how human beings perceive numbers. And there are different ways that numbers can be represented, and these are called surface formats. For example, if you have the number 2, you can represent it as the Arabic symbol for 2, which you'd use if you were doing a mathematics problem. You could also write it in a letter form, such as TWO, or you could represent it more abstractly by, let's say, having 2 dots side by each. Some theories predict that the surface format, or this style in which a number is represented, has a crucial effect on the way that the numerical magnitude is processed by the human brain. And by numerical magnitude, all we're talking about is value. So if you write the letter to an Arabic symbol, if you write it in letter form, does that affect how your brain perceives the value of the number? And how quickly does the brain respond to the value depending upon how the number is represented? So there are 2 studies that have been published recently that further explore this idea that how we perceive numbers is contingent upon how we represent them to us. And we're cultural animals, so this is important to understand not only how the human brain can conceive of higher mathematics, because we're not exclusive in being able to have some idea or concept of numbers and values. Other animals can recognize if there are more or less of something, for example, other predators. But as far as we know it, we're the only ones to put ourselves through the rigors of something like advanced calculus. And so to understand what seems to be a unique human quality, neuroscientists have pushed this field forward and have done tests specifically to understand if symbolism of a number affects how we process it in our heads. And the part of the brain that processes numbers is called the IPS, or intraparietal sulcus. Other work has shown that semantic processes of numerical magnitude are unaffected by number format. For example, it doesn't matter how you write the number 2, you'll always recognize it as having a value of 2, and it won't make a difference in how quickly you recognize its value. These 2 studies that I'm going to tell you about now that were published in Neuron just this year did an MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, of the brain in the participants. And these 2 studies were published by 2 groups, Piazza and colleagues and Cohen Kadosh and colleagues. And they took different approaches to trying to get at the same or similar questions. The Piazza et al. Study probed the extent to which similar populations of neurons in this IPS, or intraparietal sulcus, which is located in each hemisphere of the brain, so left and right, responded to symbolic, such as Arabic numerals, and non-symbolic, such as arrays of dots, representations of numerical magnitude. They presented various permutations of Arabic numerals or arrays of dots, and they did it within a close numerical range like 17, 18, 19 for 2 minutes each time. And what they tried to do was see through the MRI how the brain responded and whether or not there were differences in the recognition of the values. And they found that, in fact, there was none. The one thing that they did find, though, that was very interesting is that while there was an independence of how a number is represented to how its value is perceived, the distance between this, because there was a slight distance in both right and left IPS areas, the left had an even smaller distance than the right. So it would appear that the left part of the brain in this parietal sulcus is more adept at recognizing number values regardless of how they're represented. This also suggests a special role for the left IPS in the representation of enculturated symbolic representations of number value. So in other words, math is math, numbers are numbers, they have absolute values, but how they're represented to human beings may be filtered through the left IPS, and it may be specific to the left IPS, and something that the right side of that part of the brain simply isn't capable of doing or hasn't adapted to do. The other study by Cohen Kadosh et al. Assesses cross-notational adaptation effects of Arabic symbols and number words. So it doesn't do anything to do with abstract symbols such as dots, but it's like writing the number 10 in letter form versus number form. And they compare neuron activation underlying sequential presentation of two numerical stimuli. So basically they're going to show you either the number 2 written as a number form, 2-2, or they'll write the number 2 and then in letter form, or they'll do something like the number 2 and then the number 6 written in letter form. So they're really trying to see if the brain can pick out, regardless of how the number is represented, the ways in which they're the values of the number. They found that the left IPS adapts to number quantity regardless of whether the number is represented in Arabic numerals, number words, or a mixed format. But in the right IPS, format and number quantity were found to interact significantly. So what these findings really say is that while quantity adaptation in the left IPS is independent of stimulus format, so how it's represented as a number, the right IPS only adapts to quantity when represented in Arabic numerals. So again, this is going on to say that in the left part of the brain, there's this independence where it doesn't matter how you represent a number, the left brain gets the value, but the right side of the brain is much more stringent in how it interprets a number value, depending upon how it's represented. Both studies basically present evidence for notation-independent coding in parietal regions, but at the same time showing subtle effects that point to the influence of surface format or how numbers are represented on how the brain processes numerical values or magnitudes. Now, these findings then go on to suggest that the left IPS has a very strong role and has become specialized for symbolic and enculturated representations of quantity that might be afforded by connections with left frontal language-related regions of the brain. And this sort of goes back to left side, right side language and behavioral differences. You know, people try and categorize you as being, oh, you're a left brain thinker or a right brain thinker. And because this strong symbolic capacity is evident in this left intraparietal sulcus, it very well may have something to do with how we symbolize numbers and mathematics, and perhaps why we're capable of doing very complicated, sophisticated, high-level orders of mathematical problems. There's evidence for the IPS being important from other studies as well in terms of dealing with symbolism of numbers. Damage to the left parietal regions has been consistently associated with calculation defects. This was a study published by Dahini and Cohen in 1995. And Isaacs and colleagues in 2001 found that children born with very low birth rate, who later showed deficits in calculation abilities, also had less gray matter volume in the left parietal cortex compared to those who didn't have such mathematical problems. And Rivera and colleagues in 2005 published work that found that the left IPS became increasingly specialized for the representation of numerical operations, but the right IPS really didn't change at all between children and adults in their developmental studies, suggesting that the left IPS responds to developmental and learning and cultural stimulus, whereas the right IPS does not. So maybe this explains in some part why I totally suck at mathematical word problems. You know, where a train is going 50 kilometers an hour in one direction and a man is running 2 kilometers an hour in the opposite direction and blah, blah, blah. And I really have a brain freeze when it comes to those problems. It's sort of a deer in the headlights response. I blame my left IPS for that. And interestingly, the left IPS is better capable and is the center of the brain that functions when asked to do guesstimates of numbers or of values and quantities. So the next time that you have one of those guess the number of jelly beans in the jar competitions, you're most likely engaging your left IPS. Now, this story may have quite an interesting meaning for a story that was published in 2006 in May in Spiegel Online, and it was about a tribe in Brazil that had never previously been studied and that has really rocked the world of linguistics because it's basically overturned much of the popular dogma in that field. There's a fellow named Daniel Everett, who is a British ethnologist, who went in 1977 to live and study this tribe called the Parajas in Brazil. Daniel Everett spent a total of 7 years living with the Parajas and learning their language, but it took him about 30 years to actually publish his findings because he was so concerned with the impact that they would have on the linguist community and the research dogma that it had been adhered to and supported by people as high profile as Noam Chomsky. So Everett waited this long to publish his findings because, in fact, he didn't even trust himself because he is the only person to date other than the Parajas who understand their language. And in fact, that makes it difficult to test his published results. The Parajas are a small hunting and gathering tribe, a population of about 310 to 350 people. And they have this language that basically is completely different to anything else studied. Now, human language is unique, even though, of course, other animals have complicated and sophisticated modes of communication. But our language is deemed to be unique because we, thus far, are the only animal we know of that can communicate symbolic thoughts and concepts that are not in the present and that are really unconceived of, for example, Einstein's theory of relativity, or discussing what will happen in the future, or something as wacky as a fantasy Pegasus. All these things have never been observed in animals other than modern humans. Now, the Parajas really go against all of this because they don't have a concept of time in their language, nor do they have a concept of numbers or mathematics. There are things that are deemed essential to and universal to modern human language that the Parajas simply don't have. These include pronouns, which are things like it, he, and they, instead of referring to John or his coat. Further, they don't have subclauses, which are parts of a sentence that can't stand alone. For example, if I live through this, or when we're done this job, blah, 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 blah. And in fact, they will say things like, I have finished eating, I speak with you, instead of when I have finished eating, we will talk. Now, what's more perplexing, as I mentioned, is in their everyday lives, they appear to have no need for numbers. Never once did Everett hear words akin to all, or every, or more. And there was only one word he heard called hoi, which comes close to the number one and is used in the context to describe smaller or larger quantities. And it seems that the Parajas don't actually get the concept of numbers. Peter Gordon, a psycholinguist at New York's Columbia University, tried to teach them mathematics, whether it was counting on the fingers or using actual Brazilian words for numbers. And at the end of an 8-month period, the Parajas couldn't even, not even one person, could count to 10. Now, it's not that these people are stupid. I mean, they've been reproducing with other modern humans, so there's been genetic admixture. And in terms of their IQ, they've been likened, perhaps not too favorably, to the equivalent of a freshman intellect, so certainly capable of learning elementary math. What's really rocking the linguistic world here is that the Parajas go back to support a theory that had been previously discounted, which was something proposed by the linguist Benjamin Whorf, who died in 1941. And under Whorf's theory, people are only capable of constructing thoughts for which they possess actual words. And it seems to be the case that because the Parajas don't have words for such things as numbers, they actually can't grasp these concepts. Now, this has created such a furore that even two colleagues of Noam Chomsky will travel to this tribe in Brazil to check Everett's claims in person. No one can presently confirm or deny Everett's observations because, as I mentioned, no one can actually speak the language. So we'll have to see how that plays out. You're listening to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Julia. This is a pre-recorded show. The next song we're going to listen to is a Lemonheads cover of an old Schoolhouse Rock song called Zero, My Hero.
Zero?
Yeah. Zero is a wonderful thing. In fact, Zero is my hero.
How can Zero be a hero?
Well, there are all kinds of heroes. You know, a man can get to be a hero for a famous battle he fought, or by studying very hard, becoming a weightless astronaut.
Wow.
And then there are heroes of other sorts, like the heroes, you know, from watching sports.
Oh.
But a hero doesn't have to be a grown-up person, you know. A hero can be a very big dog who comes to your rescue, or a very little child who's smart enough to know what to do. So let me tell you about my favorite hero.
The next story comes from Nature. This is something that was published back in April of 2006, and it actually leads to what could be an interesting party game amongst you and your friends if you happen to be a guy. You can measure your level of testosterone by comparing the length of your index and ring fingers, and a relatively long finger is a sign of a man with a high testosterone level. I'm raising this because this Nature news article covered a study that was done by some researchers from Belgium in the University of Leuven, and they were looking at the effects of seeing sexily clad women or scantily clad women on the ability of men to haggle. And they did this by collecting groups of men as a sample and using the finger test to determine whether or not these men had relatively high or low levels of testosterone. And I don't know the science behind the finger test, but let's assume that this is sound. And they asked these men to play an ultimatum game where the men were given, well, one man was given 10 euros and he had to split it with his partner, who was also a man in this game. And if the offer was not accepted by the partner, who had already disclosed in secret the minimum that he would accept, then neither man got any money at all. So, and I've played this kind of game in psychology studies where you know, it's good to kind of shoot 60-40 or 50-50, something like that, so you're not offending the person and you both get some dosh. But what these men did was they played this ultimatum game, and then the researchers showed them a picture of a woman in lingerie, and they found that not the low-level testosterone men, so the ones with the relatively short ring finger, but the guys who had high testosterone were less willing to haggle for euros. In other words, they drove less of a hard bargain after they'd seen the sexy photograph of the woman. And it wasn't even a photograph that had an effect. As another permutation of this study, the researchers gave the men a bra to fondle before they did the ultimatum game again. And they found that even just having a bra present in the room made these high testosterone guys lose it a little bit. And the researchers tried to explain this in different ways. They raised the effects of advertisements so that advertisers recognize that inserting a sexy or scantily clad woman into their television ad or billboard ad will make the man go a bit stupid and more likely to spend money on the product. Although you have to wonder, how long does the effect of this last, and is it something that you actually remember in your head? And then when you go to buy vodka, you think of Sky Vodka because there was a scanty picture of Heather Graham in one of their magazine promotions. And then they also suggested that it could be that the men were more relaxed in the amount of money they would accept because they just wanted to accept any amount of money and not seem cheap if there was a woman in the room. So they would drive less of a hard bargain. It could also be, and I find this outright laughable, that the sight of a potential mate might actually make men more sensible. And so what they're doing is they're saying that, well, some money is better than no money, so I'm going to take any money because I need to provide for my mate. And let's think about this. If you show a man sexy photographs of a woman, do we honestly think he's going to be more sensible? Of course he would be. It raises some really interesting real-life applicable stuff. Like, if you go into, let's say, a car dealership and your salesperson happens to be a high testosterone man, is it worth your while to bring back your sister in, you know, a bikini when you're figuring out your total price and trying to haggle for a deal? Or is this an advantage for women? I mean, is it that she has to wear lingerie, or is a more sexy business suit can lend you some advantage when you're at the table trying to make a deal with someone or ask for a raise? And it would be interesting to see just how much skin is needed to make an effect on these high testosterone men. The other thing that's interesting about this is if the man was haggling not just for money for himself, but if he was haggling for something that his lady friend would want, is he still prone to make a worse deal if this provider theory is true, and so he's less stringent with his haggling because he just wants to provide for his mate and be sensible? Then you'd think he'd actually drive a harder bargain when it would come to things that would be really necessary for living. And another thing that I don't know if these researchers are going to do it, but it would be really cool to look at the hormones released in the high testosterone versus the low testosterone men after they've been shown these pictures of lingerie, to see why it is in the high testosterone guys that they go a bit stupid, but the low testosterone ones don't. And maybe then you have an advantage. If you have a relatively shorter ring finger and thus have lower testosterone, you're less prone to get stupid when you see a girl in a bikini. And that must be incredibly reassuring.
You know you are. folks there.
That was Mr. Jimi Hendrix recording Foxy Lady live at the Royal Albert Hall in London, UK. You're listening to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM. We're doing our Best of Science 2006 with a bit of science news sprinkled in between. So I suppose the bane of the new year, in addition to putting all your hopes and expectations on 1 second that takes place out of an entire 365 days, is the New Year's resolution. And these are things that some people look forward to when they embrace the new and the opportunity to make change for the better. And there are those of us who just think it's all a bit of hooey and we end up making resolutions that we then proceed to break later on. But in the spirit of making New Year's resolutions that we will actually keep for the next 365 days and perhaps beyond, Scientific American has assembled its list of the five New Year's resolutions that you owe yourself. Now, if you're not a fan of things such as keeping fit and eating well and taking care of yourself, you're really going to hate these resolutions, because that's essentially what they are. But they differ in that Scientific American went and based them on published literature and scientific data and expert consultations. So the first of these five is, no surprise here, to stay active. Apparently, exercising 3 times a week for about 30 minutes each session has been shown to cut cardiac morbidity and mortality by more than 10%, so essentially dying of a heart attack. And to reap the maximum benefits from this 30-minute session of exercise, you have to keep your pulse above 100 beats per minute. So not just a leisurely walk, but something that will actually get you slightly out of breath. Now, the second of these five resolutions is to eat healthily. Again, no big surprise. Reducing cholesterol intake by 20% and getting total cholesterol levels below 180 will improve anyone's risk of heart disease by 20 to 30%. And to do this, you should include the recommended daily intake of fruit and veg. The Canada Food Guide would set this, as does other food guides, at least 5 servings of fruit and veg a day. This ensures that you get the vitamins and minerals that you need. It also will increase your uptake in fiber, and it will help you feel more full throughout the day, and thus reducing your inclination to snack in between meals. What you should aim for when you're at the dinner table or the lunch table is to eat just until you feel a little bit less than full. So if you're feeling full, you're doing the Christmas thing still, and you're packing in too much food. You want to feel like you could eat just a little bit more, but you don't. Now, the third resolution is to quit smoking. Shock horror, right? Smoking is the leading preventable cause of death in the U.S. and presumably also here in Canada. And the World Health Organization estimates that in developed countries, roughly a quarter of male deaths and nearly a tenth of female deaths can be attributed to smoking. Cigarette smoke contains 69 known carcinogens, which means things that cause cancer. And it increases risks for most forms of cancer then, surprise, surprise. In addition to increasing your risk of getting cancer, smoking increases blood pressure and risk of heart disease, as well as decreasing your good HDL cholesterol levels. Now, there's also the financial cost. In addition to all the money that's spent on treating people who have smoking-related diseases, smoking itself costs quite a bit, from hundreds to thousands of dollars every year. Now, this next New Year's resolution is kind of interesting because it suggests that you drink less or maybe more. It turns out that people who are moderate drinkers, which means that if you're a man, you have no more than 2 drinks a day, and if you're a woman, you have no more than 1 drink per day, actually are more healthy than heavy drinkers or people who drink very rarely or not at all. Now, of course, excessive drinking increases your risk of liver disease, psoriasis, heart disease. It can increase your blood pressure, can make you more likely to suffer from stroke and inflammation of the pancreas, and again, certain forms of cancer. But people who are moderate drinkers have a lower risk for heart disease and death by heart attack or stroke. And researchers think that this is because moderate drinking thins the blood down and suppresses the formation of clots that can cause heart attacks and strokes. And of course, those of us who have done long-haul flights know that it's recommended to have alcohol with your meal because it thins your blood and decreases the likelihood that you're going to develop deep vein thrombosis and some kind of blood clot when you're sitting for long periods of time. Now, further, alcohol seems to enhance the body's ability to break down small clots. So if you want to improve your health, maybe you should have a glass of wine at dinner every night. The fifth recommendation for New Year's resolutions is to relieve stress. And wouldn't we all love to do this? Apparently, extreme stress leads your body to produce cytokines or other inflammatory agents. And in chronic stress, you carry on such a high a natural response to stress that your body wears down. And maybe this is why, after a really stressful day, people relax with a glass of wine or, let's say, a finger of scotch. So there seems to be this link, then, between relieving stress and drinking and increasing your health. Chronic stress can cause excessive blood clotting, leading to blockages and strokes. So again, it seems to be a good partner with a glass of wine. And chronic stress also decreases the responsiveness of the immune system. And we've heard that if you are an optimistic person with a hopeful attitude, you tend to have a stronger immune system and you get ill with less frequency than if you have a pessimistic attitude and you feel badly about things. And of course, chronic stress can do this in people. So it's suggested that you focus on the things that are within your control. You change what you can change. If you can't, then you go with the flow. And if that's not even good enough, then hopefully you can divulge yourself of the situation entirely. We've just finished talking about ways to relieve stress and improve your cardiovascular health and your health overall. And this is a nice segue into a study that was published just at the top of the year in 2007 in the International Journal of Obesity. And it's entitled Energy Expenditure of Genuine Laughter. It's by Bukowski et al. Interestingly, this study says that its intent was, and I'm half quoting here, despite inconclusive evidence, the idea that laughter has positive health benefits has been attributed to changes in musculoskeletal, cardiovascular, endocrine or hormonal, immunological and or neural systems, including reduced muscle tension, increased oxygenation of blood, heart exercise, and endorphin production. More specific effects of laughter have included improvements in type 2 diabetes patients, increases of leptin concentration in breast milk, which gives a feeling of satiation to the baby, and protection for the heart. Now, elevated heart rate and muscle movements have been observed during laughter, and they suggest a possibility that energy expenditure is increased when you laugh. So obviously you're using muscles, you're engaging your heart, and thus it could be considered a form of exercise, but this hasn't been tested. So the null hypothesis in this study was that energy expended during episodes of laughter would not differ significantly from the energy that you'd use up when you were resting. So what they set out to test was whether or not laughing genuinely throughout the day for a given amount of time would give you an exercise benefit. Now, there's two different types of laughter that the scientists running the study set out to test, and this was fake laughter and genuine laughter. And involuntary or contrived laughter was not expected to create this benefit because it wasn't something that engaged the body in the same way that genuine laughter did. Now here they characterized a laugh as a single episode or utterance usually involving one exhalation and or inhalation. And they coded the laughter in the wavefronts of the laughter. They had the participants come. Each brought a friend, and they sat in a room and watched film footage, some of which was intended to evoke a laugh or laughter. And the participants weren't told the real purpose of the study, so there was no predisposition towards laughing or not. And in this room, there was this metabolic reader that basically calculated their oxygen and then translated that into energy expenditure to test whether or not laughing used up more energy than not laughing at all and just simply sitting in a chair in the rest position watching the film. And in fact, it's been demonstrated that watching television lowers your resting metabolic rate. So that's sort of an interesting aside to just how much more the laughter would increase their metabolic rate or their energy expenditure. Now, sedentary activities like clerical work, writing and reading, or playing cards can also increase energy expenditure by approximately 10 to 20%. And to put this into a greater context, other forms of more intense physical activity, such as jogging or doing things like cleaning house, can increase your energy expenditure by 100% or even more. So in that context, the researchers calculated that the energy cost of laughing genuinely for 15 minutes ranged from 40 to 170 kilojoules or 10 to 40 kilocalories, depending upon individual body weight and laughter intensity. So at the end of the day, if you can manage to accumulate 15 minutes of genuine hearty laughter each day, you're burning the equivalent of a cookie. And let's not undersell that. Further to the five Scientific American resolutions for the new year, you can add a sixth one on behalf of Bukowski and colleagues and my science project, which is to hit a minimum target of laughing 15 minutes each day. The last two stories that I'll leave you with are the